KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. More than a dozen states are suing the Trump administration. They say the mass firing of probationary federal workers is illegal. We'll hear from Arizona's Attorney General Chris Mays on Morning Edition from NPR News. In almost every state, student achievement in math is below pre-pandemic levels, except for one. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. We'll hear how Alabama fourth graders' math scores improved to buck the national trend. Also, a preliminary hearing in New York in the case of the Columbia graduate student who helped lead pro-Palestinian protests. And how does a parent with cancer take care of themselves and their kid, too? It's Wednesday, March 12th. Happy birthday to Liza Minnelli with a Z. She turns 79 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks opened mixed this morning as the Labor Department reported cooler than expected inflation last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 100 points in early trading.
Consumer prices in February were up 2.8% from a year ago. That's a smaller annual increase than the previous month and slightly less than forecasters had expected. Housing costs continued to climb in February, but gasoline prices were down for the month, while grocery prices held steady. There's no break yet in the price of eggs, however. They jumped more than 10% in February amid the ongoing shortage linked to avian flu. News of cooling inflation comes on the same day President Trump imposed 25% tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. Those and other import taxes threatened by the president could put more upward pressure on prices. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The European Union says it will retaliate for President Trump's new tariffs on aluminum and steel. EU officials say they will impose tariffs on about $28 billion worth of imported U.S. goods. These levies will begin April 1st. President Trump's efforts to downsize the federal government now include firing about half the workforce at the U.S. Department of Education. NPR's Janaki Mehta reports that's according to a statement from the agency.
The announcement says affected staff will be placed on administrative leave beginning March 21st. The statement confirms all divisions within the agency will be hit by cuts. But it also says the Education Department will continue to deliver programs protected by law, including, quote, student loans, Pell Grants, funding for special needs students, and competitive grant making. According to the announcement, 1,950 positions will be cut, including 600 employees who accepted voluntary resignations over the last 2 months. Exactly who will be laid off is still unclear. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
The Kremlin says it is waiting to be briefed on yesterday's conversation between top U.S. and Ukrainian officials. They discussed ending Russia's war in Ukraine. Secretary of State Marco Rubio led the U.S. delegation. He says Ukraine has agreed to observe a 30-day ceasefire with Russia. Rubio says he expects to be in contact with Russian officials today.
We're going to bring it to them directly. We're going to say that Ukraine is prepared to stop all battlefield activity and begin the immediate process of negotiating an enduring end to the war. And we'll see what their response is. If their response is yes, then we know we've made real progress and there's a real chance of peace. If their response is no, it would be highly unfortunate, and it would make their intentions clear.
After the talks between the U.S. and Ukraine concluded yesterday, President Trump said he has restored intelligence sharing and U.S. military aid to Ukraine. This is NPR. Security officials in Pakistan say they've rescued nearly 200 people from a train hijacked by militants. There were more than 400 people aboard. The train was stopped yesterday as it drove through a tunnel. Nearly all the ballots are counted in Greenland's parliamentary elections. The political parties that want to seek independence from Denmark got the most votes. Greenland is getting a lot of international attention. Terry Schultz reports that's because President Trump has insisted he wants the U.S. to take over the world's largest island.
Independence from Denmark was not on the ballot, but Greenland's new parliament is likely to take it up quickly. With nearly all ballots counted, Greenland's center-right opposition party, Demokratiet, which is pro-independence, has taken the biggest share, almost a third. Another opposition party, Nalarok, also pro-independence, will come in second. The third highest vote-getter, the current ruling party, shares the same position. Greenland is a semi-autonomous territory in charge of its own domestic affairs, but with Copenhagen controlling its foreign and defense policy. Citizens have long debated seeking full autonomy, and in recent years, according to polls, it's become the majority opinion. Polls also show while Greenlanders no longer want to be part of Denmark, they don't want to join the U.S. either. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz.
NASA has launched a new telescope into space. The Sphere-X Observatory was aboard a rocket launched last night from Vandenberg Space Force Base in California. Sphere-X will work a little differently from the James Webb and Hubble telescopes. It will take in the total glow produced by all the galaxies it can see, including light from when the universe was born. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. New tariffs are in effect today. Higher taxes on steel and aluminum coming into the U.S. The European Union said this morning that the move is unjustified. It will have its own counter tariffs next month, putting back into effect some that were on hold, and there will be new products that will be more expensive. This caps a chaotic 24 hours in which President Trump announced and then rescinded even higher tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum. NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben is here to tell us more about all this. Good morning, Danielle.
Good morning, Michelle.
Okay, so tell us more about the American tariffs going into effect today.
Sure. So these are 25% tariffs on all steel and aluminum imports. They went into effect at midnight. And this is an expanded version of the steel and aluminum tariffs Trump imposed in his first term. Those had exceptions for some countries, including Canada and Mexico. But these tariffs happening now are on all countries, all steel and aluminum, no exceptions. Again, to explain, a tariff is a tax that companies in the U.S. pay for goods they import. It is not, as Trump has said, money that other countries or companies pay to the U.S. So American companies that use steel and aluminum, like car manufacturing, energy, they might all face higher costs now, meaning consumers could see higher prices in those areas.
You know, there was a lot of drama over what these tariffs would look like for Canada specifically. So tell us more about what happened there.
Yeah. So earlier this week, in response to tariffs Trump had imposed on Canada, Ontario Premier Doug Ford announced a 25% surcharge on electricity exports from his province. So that would raise prices for American consumers. Well, Tuesday morning, Trump announced that in return, he would make Canada's steel and aluminum tariffs 50, not 25%. That would be a very big deal, as Canada is the largest supplier of both steel and aluminum to the U.S. But then a few hours later, the administration said, wait, we have an agreement. Ford would remove the surcharge, and Canadian officials would come to Washington this week to discuss renegotiating the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, which is something Trump negotiated in his first term. In addition, The Trump administration said they'd impose 25% tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum as they're doing for everyone else. So, yes, this is a drawdown, but first of all, this shows just how chaotic Trump's tariff policy can be. And furthermore, 25% tariffs on all steel and aluminum, that's still substantial. It's going to have real economic effects.
Well, we're already seeing some of those effects, it would seem, in stock markets and consumer confidence. So what is Trump saying about that? What's his rationale here?
Well, for these particular steel and aluminum tariffs, the administration has said national security is the rationale. They want to boost the American steel and aluminum industries. However, the evidence from the last time Trump imposed this type of tariff suggests they weren't really the boon Trump wanted them to be. But to zoom out here, businesses and consumers are scared by all of this. First off, because, like we've said, tariffs can cause higher prices. They can also lead to retaliation like the EU is doing. But there's also just the uncertainty Trump injects into all of this. This term so far has been a flurry of tariffs imposed, tariff threats, tariff delays. All that uncertainty means businesses and consumers don't know what's coming, might hold back on spending. And by the way, there are more potential tariffs to come. In April, Trump could start imposing what he calls reciprocal tariffs on all trading partners, meaning there's possibly still more unpredictable policy to come.
That is NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben. Daniel, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
A federal court in Maryland is hearing a case today against the Trump administration brought by Democratic state attorneys general. 19 states and the District of Columbia sued over the mass firings of tens of thousands of federal employees on probationary status. Now, one of the plaintiffs is the Attorney General of Arizona, Chris Mays. She told me the administration failed to give states the required notice.
We want the judge, obviously, to rule that these mass firings of probationary employees were illegal. We want the Trump administration to reinstate these fired employees. We want a judge to order that further similar terminations be stopped, and we want to identify all of the affected employees.
You said further terminations be stopped. So I'm wondering, Attorney General, if, say, the layoffs are put on hold or even reversed, but the Trump administration then decides to follow the letter of the law by informing states such as yours 60 days in advance, what recourse would you have then if they follow the letter of the law?
First of all, what I would say is we're going to cross that bridge if it happens. The first thing that has to happen here is the Trump administration has to follow the law. Secondly, what I would say is the Trump administration is trying to do something that fundamentally violates and abrogates the separation of powers. This level of mass firings of federal employees is something that requires the input of Congress. This is not about stopping reform. It's about reform happening the right way. And the right way is for Congress to be involved.
Is Congress required, though, to be involved if an administration, any administration, wanted to do what the Trump administration is trying to do?
I think, yes. At this level of change, with this number of mass firings, Congress does have to be involved. Now, we're looking at the entire elimination of agencies or massive reductions in workforce. Out here in Arizona, we are seeing a hotshot wildland firefighters being eliminated in the middle of fire season and entire staffs at our national parks being eliminated. The entire Phoenix GSA office, which staffs our federal courts here, eliminated. These are the kinds of decisions that are having a real-world impact on our states, but they are also fundamentally unlawful under our Constitution.
I saw in a related lawsuit from employee unions, another federal judge in San Francisco ordered a partial halt to these mass firings, including at the Department of Defense, Veterans Affairs, and the National Park Service. Also, an independent agency ordered the Department of Agriculture to give thousands of employees their jobs back. So in light of that, Attorney General, is that enough? What harm remains that your lawsuit seeks to remedy?
Well, our lawsuit covers a number of other federal agencies. So while we saw the judge's order in that case as being obviously very positive and a sign that our courts are willing to step into the breach and protect our Constitution and our federal workers, it's probably not enough. And that's why we filed our lawsuit that would cover all of these different agencies.
Attorney General, you represent a swing state, a state that narrowly voted for President Trump last year. Do you have any concerns at all about suing the administration, knowing how politically divided your state is?
No, I was elected to uphold the rule of law. I took an oath to uphold the Arizona Constitution, the federal Constitution, and the people of this state expect me to stand up for them. And you can see the impact that this is having on Arizonans from the town hall that we just had out here. We had 400 people turn out. Whole lot of Republicans, a lot of independents, and some Democrats showed up to decry what is happening, including doctors, healthcare workers, and farmers. And this is what the people of Arizona expect me to do, and I'm going to continue to do it while I'm AG.
That's Chris Mays, Attorney General for the state of Arizona. Attorney General, thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
A federal judge in New York will hold a preliminary hearing today in the case of the Columbia University graduate student who helped lead pro-Palestinian protests. Mahmoud Khalil is a lawful permanent resident who was arrested by immigration officers over the weekend. NPR's Jewel Rose reports on Khalil's case and the Trump administration's threats to arrest more student protesters.
When immigration authorities try to revoke a green card from a lawful permanent resident like Mahmoud Khalil, it's often because they're accusing someone of a crime or lying on an immigration application. But that is not what's happening here. The Trump administration has not charged Khalil with any crimes. The White House argues it doesn't have to.
This administration is not going to tolerate individuals having the privilege of studying in our country and then siding with pro-terrorist organizations that have killed Americans.
White House spokesperson Caroline Levitt says Khalil's role in protests at Columbia University, where he's a graduate student, is reason enough to revoke his green card and deport him.
This is an individual who organized group protests that not only disrupted college campus classes and harassed Jewish American students and made them feel unsafe, but also distributed pro-Hamas propaganda.
Levitt promised more arrests to come. She said the Department of Homeland Security is using intelligence to identify student protesters nationwide who are involved in what she called, quote, anti-American, anti-Semitic, pro-Hamas protests. Mahmoud Khalil rejects the allegation of anti-Semitism or that he supports Hamas. He was born and raised in Syria with Palestinian ancestry. Baher Azmi with the Center for Constitutional Rights is one of his lawyers.
All he has ever done is advocate for the human rights of Palestinians and try to draw attention to the urgent issue of an ongoing genocide against Palestinians.
Khalil was arrested over the weekend by ICE at his university housing. The Justice Department has not said anything about the legal authority for that arrest, but the administration is signaling that the case will rely on a relatively obscure provision of immigration law that gives the Secretary of State power to remove someone if their presence would have, quote, potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences for the United States. Khalil's lawyer, Baher Azmi, calls this a clear case of retaliation for speech that should be protected under the First Amendment.
Punishing someone, in this case, by arrest, detention, and attempted removal simply because the government disagrees with the political viewpoint, that is a chilling exercise of executive power that should worry all of us.
ICE is holding Khalil in Louisiana. Today, in federal court in Manhattan, his lawyers will try to argue he should be at a detention center near New York, closer to his pregnant wife and legal team. Where Khalil winds up could also matter quite a lot to his case because of big differences between courts in New York and Louisiana. Joel Rose, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Washington Post national education writer Laura Meckler joins us to discuss how the administration's calls to dismantle the Department of Education could reshape America's education landscape, impacting schools, colleges, and universities nationwide. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere at betterhelp.com/public. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. 5 years ago, the pandemic brought K-12 education grinding to a halt. The latest nation's report card shows, on average, students still haven't made up for all the learning they missed in math. But there is an exception, Alabama. NPR's Corey Turner went there to find out how they did it.
DeKalb County sits in the northeast corner of Alabama. It's rural, tucked into the shadow of Lookout Mountain, with a majority of students coming from lower-income households. And its math classes are noisy. While many school districts across the country saw their math scores go down during the pandemic, DeKalb's went up. Students returned for in-person learning sooner than they did in many places. But during the pandemic, the district also started a math makeover in its elementary schools.
Two-digit by two-digit multiplication, and you're going to build it, okay?
Instead of relying on worksheets and rote memorization, district leaders wanted to make math more engaging for young learners by making it more concrete. So when I visited, in the back of every classroom, I found these big containers of stuff. There's a drawer with wooden cubes, and a drawer with pattern blocks made of foam. And then there are fraction tiles. They have decimals written on one side, looks like fractions on the other. Making math this concrete for young learners helps build their math fluency, like learning a language. And it's fluency that then allows them to do what I saw in Ms. Tracy Butts' third grade classroom.
All right, I've got it covered up.
Butts leads her kids to the back of the room where they sit on the floor crisscross applesauce. On the wall, on a giant sheet of paper, she's written an equation, 9 times 12.
Hands on your chest.
But the kids don't have pencils or paper to solve it the standard way.
All right, so remember, one thumbs up is I have one, I have my answer, and I have one strategy to solve.
Butts asks the kids to think not about the one way to solve 9 times 12, but how many different ways they can solve it in their heads.
I saw some of you found 3 ways to find it. You had 5 ways.
One girl counted by nines, 9, 18, 27, until she'd done it 12 times. Another took a different route.
I broke the 12 apart into 10 and 2.
Because 10 times 9 is easy. It's 90. And 2 times 9 is 18. You add them up, and you get 108. It is a judgment-free zone here, where the kids are encouraged to find their own way to the answer, and they seem genuinely excited doing it. This approach has helped set DeKalb apart, and Alabama with it, as the only state where fourth grade math scores are better now than they were before the pandemic.
And we wanted to bring math alive. I was like, let's bring our math curriculum alive.
Julie West has been a driving force behind these changes in DeKalb County. She grew up here, went to school here, taught math, became a principal here. And then a few years ago, her superintendent used some of the district's federal COVID relief money to give her her toughest job yet, as a district-wide elementary math leader, working with K-5 teachers to reimagine their approach to math.
Instead of working out problems and models on a page, let's get them out and let the kids touch them.
hold them, manipulate them.
The district used COVID relief funding to buy a bunch of those counting blocks and shapes and rainbow-colored measuring sticks so kids can feel the math. West also worked with a group of math teachers to quickly carve up their textbooks to be more aligned with the state's math standards.
This lesson doesn't meet our standards. This chapter's no good. This is better.
West then began coaching K-5 teachers, knowing many in the early grades don't get a lot of math training and maybe don't even feel comfortable teaching it. And the district made clear everyone, from teachers to administrators, should be looking at the data. In fact, that is West's favorite four-letter word.
Data, or it didn't happen. Don't tell me you did something unless you have the proof that you did it.
This data focus was on full display on a recent Wednesday.
When we know better, we do better. That's my favorite saying.
Lydia Peek is an assistant principal in the district. She's leading a quick check-in with her early grade math teachers. Invoking West's favorite four-letter word, Peek pulls up the data from one recent math quiz.
So you can see, like, when you click in, it will even show you which ones they missed.
Peek zooms in on the results for one fourth grader.
He got this one right, then he got this one wrong, and it even gives you why they might have missed it.
Several teachers, including Tanya Ford, say they love the district changes.
We've not always had that kind of support from our administrators, and I mean, we didn't used to have a math coach.
But now, Ford School has its very own math coach.
We're able to swim through it all together instead of just feeling like you're out there by yourself.
After DeKalb County began this math makeover, Alabama education leaders began pushing many of the same ideas statewide. Thanks to the Alabama Numeracy Act, a state law that passed in 2022 with a big push from State Superintendent Eric Mackey.
Math, when it is properly applied, is not about just solving math problems. Math is a way of thinking about the world. It really is the language of philosophy.
Mackey, a former science teacher, hopes to use this law to put a math coach, like Julie West, in every elementary school in the state to support and grow great math teachers.
So they are teaching students how to approach, how to think about, and how to solve problems, not just how to work the algorithm.
Okay, let's hop back here to the number talk.
In Tracy Butt's third grade math class, the kids came up with at least five different ways to solve 9 times 12. And if you're still not convinced they're having fun too, well, just listen to this. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40, 45, 50. As one DeKalb teacher told me, the big math gains they've seen here shouldn't be a surprise. When kids have fun, they learn. Corey Turner, NPR News, DeKalb County, Alabama.
This is NPR News. The Trump administration has targeted parts of the government that could serve as a check on President Trump. For example, the firing of inspectors general across 18 federal agencies.
If one really were serious about limiting wasteful spending, the last people you'd get rid of were the inspectors general. That is precisely their jobs.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A breakdown of Trump's attacks on the government on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The president of the European Commission says President Trump's 25% tariffs on U.S. imports of steel and aluminum are a bad idea.
We deeply regret this measure. Tariffs are taxes.
They are bad for business and worse for consumers. They are disrupting supply chains. They bring uncertainty for the economy. Jobs are at stake.
That's Ursula von der Leyen speaking today in Brussels. She says the EU is retaliating with tariffs on about $28 billion worth of American industrial and agricultural goods beginning April 1st. Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum took effect this morning. The House has passed a short-term spending bill to keep the federal government funded through September. Republicans will need the support of Democratic lawmakers to win passage in the Senate. But Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware says his party is taking a different approach.
We're going to work to get a vote on the floor of a 30-day continuing resolution to keep the government open while we finish our appropriations bills.
He was speaking to NPR's Morning Edition. Congress has until Friday night to pass legislation to avert a partial shutdown of the federal government. This is NPR News from Washington. There's still no formal response from Moscow to a U.S. proposal for a 30-day ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine. Kyiv agreed to the plan yesterday following hours of talks with a U.S. delegation in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. It was led by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who says the Trump administration expects to be in contact with Russian officials today. The former president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, is expected to arrive in the Netherlands today to face charges of crimes against humanity. As Villa Marx reports, Duterte was arrested on a warrant from the International Criminal Court in The Hague.
Duterte's successor and political rival, current President Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr., announced Duterte's arrest in the capital, Manila. Marcos, whose own father ran the country as an increasingly authoritarian leader from the mid-1960s to mid-1980s, said the ICC's arrest warrant had prompted an Interpol red notice, which in turn obliged Filipino police to arrest Duterte. ICC prosecutors linked Duterte to multiple extrajudicial killings carried out during his time in office as he sought to stamp out the country's drug trade using often brutal tactics he once gleefully celebrated. Now, the 79-year-old, who left office in 2022 but remains popular, will face charges related to the deadly crackdown on drugs during his presidency. He's questioned the basis for the warrant. For NPR News, I'm Willem Muggs.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 186 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The clock is ticking in Washington on a potential government shutdown. Funding for federal agencies expires Friday at midnight,
leaving the Senate with less than 72 hours to pass a stopgap spending plan. The Republican plan passed the House yesterday. Here is Speaker Mike Johnson after the vote.
It falls on the desk of Chuck Schumer. He is the leader of the Democrats on that side, and he must determine whether he wants to fund the government, do the responsible thing, or whether he wants to shut the government down.
NPR's congressional correspondent is Claudia Grisales. So, Claudia, let's start with that stopgap plan that passed the House. What to do?
Right, it extends a current stopgap spending plan through the end of the fiscal year, so through September at lower 2024 levels. This in particular was key to keeping hardline members on board for these forced cuts that we would see in some cases. It's a feature of these kinds of stopgap bills, also known as continuing resolutions, to keep spending flat. But it's also a rarity to see Congress to fund the government this way for an entire year. Traditionally, we see them pass a full year appropriations plan, but bipartisan negotiations failed to come together in time, so Republicans turned to this partisan plan instead.
Yeah, when it comes to spending, Republicans have tended to disagree on a few things, or maybe a lot of things. How do they get this across the finish line?
Historically, we've seen hardline members of the conference always vote no, but in this case, they were yes, some for the first time voting yes on a plan like this. It says a lot about the influence of President Trump. For example, hours before the vote, Trump said he would lead an effort to have a member of the conference, this is Kentucky Republican Thomas Massey, primaried because he was the lone no vote for the party in the House. And this happened again just before the vote. And within that same window, we saw a handful of holdouts fall in line who were undecided and vote yes.
All right, as Speaker Johnson said, it now goes to the Senate, Republican-led Senate. Can they get this thing passed before that Friday deadline?
Maybe, but it could be very close. In this case, they're going to need Democrats to get this done. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, like Speaker Johnson, they're putting the heat on Democrats to get on board or be responsible for a government shutdown.
As you all know, it takes 60 votes in the Senate to pass an appropriations bill. So we're going to need some Democrats to vote for it.
And Republicans control just a slim majority in the Senate. That's 53 seats. They're going to need 60 votes to overcome a filibuster, so they hope to get Democrats to hit that threshold. We know one Republican, Kentucky Republican Rand Paul, says he's a no vote, while one Democrat, John Fetterman, has signaled he will be the first to join the GOP to get this passed.
So seven or more Democrats to vote yes. What are Democrats saying?
Well, they wanted a plan that would put limits on Trump's ability to make cuts and dismantle the federal government. But House Democrats, while they largely held on this together to vote no, that's not as clear for Senate Democrats. They were not forthcoming yesterday in most cases on how they would vote. And that happened in the case for Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, who was asked several times about this, but would not say what the plan was. So we know they're facing pressure from both sides, and they don't want to be blamed for a government shutdown. So it's going to be a big unity test for Democrats.
All right. That's NPR's congressional correspondent, Claudia Grisales. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
One in five adults with a cancer diagnosis is a parent or a guardian with a child under 18. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports on one woman dealing with cancer as a parent as part of her series, Life After Diagnosis.
In the spring of 2022, Monique Morris was 31 and just hitting her stride in life and as a new mom.
We celebrated our son's first birthday. 3 days later, we got married. And then 6 weeks later, I was diagnosed.
Her stage 2 breast cancer diagnosis came over a phone call when Morris was working from home. Her mom, who also lives in Milwaukee, was playing with a baby in his room.
What do I say to my mom? I've had 2 siblings pass away from illness already.
Morris felt racked with guilt.
I can still see it in my head. I can see her holding him. And I can remember when I opened up the door, they looked so normal. And I just feel so awful for the fact that I'm going to ruin this moment.
She blamed herself, even, for bringing a child into the world.
The next thing that I can manage to get out of my mouth is, what about him, my son?
But baby Brandon Jr., BJ for short, had healing powers.
When it was very difficult to find a reason to smile, I could look at him and there was one right away. You can't say no to him when he's asking you to dance with him.
More and more people are facing the heightened emotions of parenting with cancer. Cancer rates are spiking at alarming rates, especially among women under 50. Facing the disease while raising kids can feel especially high stakes. Carissa Hodgson is a social worker and director of outreach at Bright Spot Network, a support group for parents with cancer. She says their number one worry is their kids' sense of well-being. To them, she says,
Kids will get through this.
They may need extra support, she says, and they need honesty. Hodgson's father died of cancer when she was 7. She says her mother's candor helped her.
She was also honest about, he's not getting better, he's going to die, and I needed that. I needed that clarity.
With children, she says, it's good to focus on the present to dissuade them from fretting about the future.
It actually helps a child to accept what's going on and work through those big feelings, because it's the fear and the unknown and feeling like you're being kept from the truth. That's what really revs up a child's fear.
Hodgson says the burdens of cancer can hit parents harder. They're younger, earlier in their careers, and face more financial demands. The strains of parenting can already feel isolating, even before the side effects of disease.
Just because there's a cancer diagnosis doesn't mean there's a magic wand that says all of your other life stressors are going to go away. And in fact, if anything, it just, you know, turns it all up.
Hodgson says that's why it's essential to find community, online or in person, with other parents with cancer. Support groups helped Monique Morris find solace in her isolation. Her cancer is in remission, but she says BJ, now 3, still seems to remember.
He wanted a doctor kit really badly. You know, I have to check mommy. I have to check mommy. And he would come with a little toy stethoscope and examine me.
Morris even sees silver lining in the experience.
I think about how compassionate he's going to be because of all of this. And I can already see that. And that warms my heart.
She thought her disease would burden him, but he's also been her salvation.
I felt so guilty at first for how much we were going to have to go through as a family, but I also have this really profound gratitude.
Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
A new Yale program hopes to shed light on why female athletes suffer from some sports injuries more than their male counterparts and how to protect against injuries. More next time, here and now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Amy Martinez. After the Yankees announced hard-throwing ace pitcher Garrett Cole needs season-ending elbow surgery, the Wall Street Journal crunched numbers. Fewer than 20 years ago, there were only 200 pitches thrown faster than 100 miles per hour every season in the big leagues. Now it's more than 3,000 per year, and surgeries have almost tripled since. Now, one proposal is to ban super-fast pitches, but therein lies the rub. Stats show those are the hardest to hit. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive. Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Two NASA astronauts stuck in space since last June are set to come home in a matter of days. Their plight has become political, as President Trump and Elon Musk have blamed the Biden administration. But other astronauts and former NASA officials say the Biden White House had nothing to do with it. Joining us now to discuss the return of the astronauts and the politics around it is NPR science correspondent Jeff Brumfield. So, Jeff, let's start with what is actually happening today.
Later today, a rocket from Elon Musk's company SpaceX is scheduled to carry four astronauts to the International Space Station. A few days after that new crew arrives, three astronauts and a Russian cosmonaut from the previous crew will return to Earth on a different SpaceX capsule. And as you said, two of those astronauts are the quote-unquote stuck astronauts. Their names are Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams. They launched last June and were supposed to be staying a week, but instead, because of problems with their experiment, spacecraft built by Boeing, they've had to switch things up, and now they're coming home probably within a week or so.
Okay, fingers crossed, I'm assuming, for everyone involved. So what about Elon Musk and President Trump? What have they been saying about why they're in space?
So Trump and Musk have been repeatedly claiming that Williams and Wilmore could have come down a long time ago, but the Biden White House kept them there. Here they are talking about it during an interview with Fox News host Sean Hannity last month.
We are accelerating the return of the astronauts, which was postponed kind of to a ridiculous degree.
They got left in space.
They've been there. They were supposed to be there 8 days. They're there almost 300.
Biden.
They were put. Yeah. Yes, they were left up there for political reasons, which is not good.
And Musk has said on his social media platform X that he could have brought home the astronauts sooner. But the astronauts themselves say they don't really know what the president and Musk are talking about. Here's Butch Wilmore in an interview from space last week.
We have no information on that, though, whatsoever. What was offered, what was not offered, who it was offered to, how that process has went. That's information that we simply don't have.
Now, active astronauts are notoriously careful when it comes to politics, but other former NASA officials and astronauts have said that Musk and Trump are just plain wrong. And it got ugly on social media when a former space station commander said the idea they were stranded for political reasons was a lie. Musk called that astronaut an idiot and worse on X, and Musk and several astronauts have been fighting on social media ever since.
Jeff, I mean, this totally sounds like the most 2025 space mission ever. Can you give us any clarity on what actually is going on, please?
Well, I'm obviously not privy to the conversations between NASA and Elon Musk, but I can tell you the following. So, fact one, NASA says pretty clearly it left the astronauts up there out of an abundance of caution, not for any political reasons. They weren't sure their original ride on this Boeing capsule was safe enough to bring them home. Second, once they were up there, they became part of a regular space station crew. So basically, they were integrated into the space station. They've been doing normal duties like experiments and spacewalks. And Sonny Williams has actually been commanding the space station for the last few months. And finally, the spacecraft going up today is not a rescue capsule. In fact, the capsule that the crew is going to take home is the same one the last crew came up on, and it's been up there since September of last year. So they could have come home at any point if they really needed to.
NPR science correspondent Jeff Brumfield, thanks.
Thank you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Thank you.
Steel and aluminum and a whole lot more than that just got a lot more expensive.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager, helping to extend spring cleaning to online security with strong and unique passwords for every account at bitwarden.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. It's not just tariffs on steel and aluminum that went into effect today. It's tariffs on hundreds of products made from those metals. Air conditioner parts, aircraft parts, kitchen appliances, nuts and bolts, bulldozer blades, gym equipment. Marketplace's Nova Sappho is here with more. Hi, Nova.
Good morning, Sabri.
So technically, we actually already had some steel and aluminum tariffs in place. This is an expansion of them. Can you break that down for us?
That's right. These tariffs date back to the first Trump administration, steel and aluminum tariffs. But there were a lot of exemptions along the way. For example, some countries like Japan had quotas with which they could export to the U.S. a certain amount of product before the higher tariffs kicked in. Now, that's all gone now. All of those derivative products also were excluded before. Now they're facing import levies. So all of this is a big change. Analysis from the Boston Consulting Group found that the new tariff rules more than double the amount of steel imports alone, Sabri, which are facing new import taxes.
And what should we expect the consequences of this to be?
Well, President Trump says he's seeking to bring more manufacturing to the U.S. to expand steel and aluminum factories, but also others, such as in auto manufacturing. That Boston Consulting Group analysis I mentioned does find that these tariffs are going to impact the manufacturing and construction industries the most. Now, interestingly, when it comes to the broader economy, S&P Global predicts that the impacts just from these specific tariffs will be relatively negligible on prices overall, but a very significant impact on specific industries like automakers. A big caveat in all of this is that analysts have not yet considered the impacts of retaliatory tariffs from other countries, and the EU has already announced that they will impose some.
All right, Marketplace's Nova Sappho, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Inflation in the United States in February cooled down quite a bit. The consumer price index dropped earlier this morning. It's a break we really needed. 2.8% yearly inflation, not quite as low as we'd like it, but better than the month before. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
Inflation rose more slowly last month. The consumer price index was up 0.2% in February, a bit cooler than the 0.5% rise in January. Almost half the CPI increase was due to the cost of shelter. Used car prices were also up. Prices for meat, poultry, fish, and eggs were up more than 1.5% in February. That was mostly driven by the soaring cost of eggs. S&P Global economists say if President Trump's tariffs are fully implemented, they'll increase U.S. inflation by 0.5 to 3/4 percentage point, with the CPI hovering around 3% through 2025, well above the Federal Reserve's inflation target of 2%. The Fed starts its next meeting on interest rates this Tuesday. With inflation so far above its target, Bank of America sees little reason for an interest rate cut. In fact, B of A expects the Fed to stay on hold through the end of next year. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is down again, 298 points. That's 0.7%. The S&P 500 is up 0.1%. The NASDAQ is up 0.9%. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.31%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. On the road and at home, customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto with Progressive Insurance. Learn more about Progressive and bundling at progressive.com. And by Commvault. When companies face ransomware and outages, they can recover data and business in just minutes with Commvault.
Now, something from the unintended consequences file. Slashing government jobs and spending has slashed government travel, and that is showing up in demand for flights. Delta, American, Southwest, United have all cut their first quarter growth forecasts or warned demand is slowing. A decline in government travel is just one reason. The big one, of course, is that consumers and businesses have been getting more anxious about the direction of the economy. This downturn comes 5 years to the week after the official start of the COVID-19 pandemic, when airlines faced a truly existential threat. This week, we're looking at how various industries have recovered from the economic shock of pandemic times and how they've been changed by it. Marketplace's Daniel Ackerman has more.
February 2020 was a pretty good time for airlines, says industry consultant Robert Mann.
The irony was early February was record traffic, record revenue.
Of course, that wouldn't last. By April, there were days when TSA screened fewer than 90,000 travelers, says Henry Hardeveldt of Atmosphere Research.
We hadn't seen a number that low in the United States since the 1950s.
With no passengers, airlines cut staff and parked their unused airplanes out in the desert. It took more than $50 billion in government support to keep airlines from going bankrupt. But then, in the middle of 2021,
as more people were vaccinated, as restrictions started to ease, we saw domestic and international travel explode, so-called revenge travel.
People wanted to get back out there and see their friends and family, says Nicholas Rupp, an economics professor at East Carolina University.
They've gotten stimulus checks, so they've got money to spend. They're ready to travel. So it was leisure travelers that first brought back the airlines.
Business travel didn't see the same rebound. Managers learned Zoom could do the trick just fine. Consultant Robert Mann says that hurt routes to and from smaller cities, where previously just a handful of business travelers could make it profitable to fly a 50-seat airplane.
They were subsidized by the five or six very high-fare business travelers who were flying in those markets. And if that type of demand doesn't exist anymore, then the cross-subsidy doesn't exist and the service will be eliminated.
Mann says some of those routes may never return, even with business travel picking up lately. The pandemic has also had a lasting impact on aircraft supply chains, says Henry Hardeveldt of Atmosphere Research. Manufacturers like Boeing and Airbus are still behind on deliveries of new planes.
So a key lesson here is when you're faced with a crisis, stay away from knee-jerk reactions. There are airlines that wish they hadn't got rid of airplanes because when demand hit, they could have used those planes.
Airlines may soon get a chance to apply some of the lessons they learned back then. This week, Delta, American, United, and Southwest all slashed their revenue forecasts as consumer sentiment runs into turbulence. I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.